Welcome to bonus episode 20 of the Gameable Saturday Morning Podcast, a tabletop role-playing podcast. In our regular episodes, we're watching cartoons from across the era of Saturday morning animation, delving into their plots, settings, and characters for gaming inspiration. But this week, we are going back down into the magical well that is anime to look at Inuyasha. I'm Chris Newton.
I'm Miles Schneiderman.
And we are back to talk about Inuyasha even more. Last time we covered its plots. I mean, we slipped into characters inevitably because I think, you know, love them or hate them, they are the thing about this show.
Yeah.
But before we get into our character discussion proper for this week, there's something I want to ask you about because, as you mentioned last time, you're on this show because I wanted to talk to you about something you hate. And you picked Inuyasha. And you mentioned that you're not much of an anime guy. Are there anime that you're into, like that you would recommend to people? I'm sure you've run across some in your Smash Fiction prep, if nothing else.
We haven't delved real heavily into anime on Smash Fiction, much to the disappointment of one of our hosts, Kit, who I'm sure would love to do more. There are a few that I have really enjoyed. I think the most notable example of that is Cowboy Bebop, which I was given to watch long time ago and really, really appreciated. I thought that was an absolutely excellent show. Another one that I kind of briefly got into because I thought the premise was really interesting was an anime called Berserk, which very quickly went off the rails for me. and it's not something that I think I would recommend. But really, aside from that, Ghost in the Shell. Like, I've seen Ghost in the Shell. Because who hasn't seen Ghost in the Shell? I mean, I've seen Akira. Like, Akira's good stuff. But aside from that, in terms of, like, anime series, I don't have a real strong versing, and most of what I have seen, you know, I've seen some of, like, Bleach and Photon and some of these other ones, and they're just really, really not good. I had to watch some Kill la Kill for Smash Fiction once, and that was, man, I know a lot of people like it, but that was god-awful.
That's on my list because of Colin from Smash Fiction, erstwhile host of Smash Fiction.
Huge fan.
He recommended that to us, I think on the basis of the connection to Panties of Legend, partly. we're going to be watching Kill la Kill at some point here. I'm not sure how much more anime we'll end up doing on Gameable, but yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I've seen the big stuff and I've appreciated the stuff that you're supposed to appreciate. Like, Ghost in the Shell is great. You know, Akira is good. I really like Perfect Blue, all that stuff. But then when it comes down to series, you know, if I just flip on Crunchyroll and go look for stuff, I feel like a lot of anime is really for anime fans and doesn't have a tremendous amount of crossover appeal. I went through a period where I would watch Dragon Ball. I'll stand behind Dragon Ball, period. Dragon Ball full stop is okay. Dragon Ball Z, like, I may or may not watch it if you put it in front of me, but I'm never going to try to convince anybody that it's good.
Yeah, it's like, it's not for me. And I think there's a lot of things that contribute to that. The first one being that I'm a big fan of American comics. And Scott McCloud has a couple of books about, like, how to think about comics. Understanding comics and making comics are two really great books just about the medium. And one of the things he talks about in those books is he mentions in Making Comics that there's four schools of kind of appreciating them visually. And I fall very heavily into what he calls the classicist school of comics, which is that I like things to be well-drawn, fairly realistic, and there are exceptions to this. You know, but for the most part, you know, as someone who grew up on superhero comics and who kind of matured in the genre that way and still holds a very, you know, special love for superhero comics, Marvel comics specifically, I really have a love for that kind of more realistic, classically drawn style. And so I have an issue with anime because of that, because anime is, and manga, is a very, very different art style. And it just doesn't appeal to me. So there's a lot of that going on. And I think, as we touched on last episode a lot, there's a lot of kind of cultural symbols and cultural kind of devices, I guess. Like, things that you wouldn't know if you're not going in with a certain amount of background. Like, you know, something as basic as the fact that, like, in anime and in manga, if there's a blood bubble popping out of someone's nose, it means they're horny. if you don't have an understanding of that already, or if you don't have someone there to explain it to you, you're going to think this person has a nosebleed and needs medical attention. And so it's always been hard for me to get into the genre because I've never had that grounding in Japanese culture that I think a lot of people like me, you know, growing up in the same era and, you know, with the same kind of sensibilities towards their fiction really delved into, like people who really got into Japanese culture and wanted to learn how to speak the language and really kind of understood the coding of these stories. And so for me, it's like, I don't get it a lot of the time.
That's exactly. I mean, what that reminds me a lot of is, you know, it was fairly recently, because I've always kind of watched professional wrestling, but I got Katrina into it pretty recently. Mm-hmm. You know, within the past few years or something. That was a distinction that I had to make when I was first sort of introducing her to it, which kind of started to happen by accident. But it was like, there are great wrestling matches that are not great wrestling matches for a new viewer because they can't really read them yet.
Right.
You need like a certain kind of introductory material to get people interested enough to learn the grammar of the medium, you know, before they can then appreciate a lot of the works in it. And so, And I think that anime is very much the same way. It's like there are specific series and movies that have a lot of crossover appeal because they don't require you to have that grounding. And then there are others that I'm sure are great, but yeah, I can't read them properly because of the lack of grounding. And I think there is that like fascination with Japanese culture that often goes with a hardcore anime fan because that's what drives you to learn enough to be able to appreciate, you know, the work.
And wrestling's a great example. I mean, it's really the two genres of storytelling are similar in so many ways because, you know, as a wrestling fan, you get embarrassed by a lot of this shit sometimes. Like, what mm-hmm. I always tell people is, like, look, get into wrestling, but be advised that, like, 80% of it is garbage.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of wrestling that's not good. But for me, that 20%... is some of the greatest storytelling ever devised, you know, and it's like, and people who don't watch wrestling will never understand how I could possibly get, you know, emotional over, you know, Sami Zayn finally winning the NXT championship from Neville at NXT TakeOver R Evolution because they don't understand, you know, the coding. And
exactly.
Like you said, the grammar of it, they don't understand why it's important or why it's meaningful. So I would never begrudge anyone who's into anime. And I don't want to, I don't want any of what I have to say about Inuyasha to come off as, you know, oh, he just really doesn't like Japanese animation or thinks it's like fundamentally wrong for some reason.
Yeah. And that's where maybe we're going to sort of transition into the gaming stuff. I think it's important to have this conversation because The takeaway is, number one takeaway, please, for God's sake, don't email me saying that anime is great and give it a chance. I understand in theory that it's very valid. There's a lot of it that's enjoyable. And I think that, you know, neither you nor I, Miles, are saying it's bad.
No,
just that
no,
it's
no,
not
no.
our thing.
Yeah.
But secondly, from a gaming perspective, a big part of the issue with something like Inuyasha, to me at least, is the genre stuff. It's not even the specific stuff. It's the fact that this is such like a type specimen of hokey anime that I don't enjoy,
mm-hmm.
that for me to get the stuff out of it that is good and that I would enjoy, I have to find a way to take those other elements out or transform them somehow.
Yeah.
And that's really gaming relevant. I, you know, there's countless times when I've had a group and there's something I really want to run or want to play, but there's one person who just does not get into that. And you have to try to find a way, either you have to give it up or you have to find a way to like, okay, but what if we skew it this way? Like, okay, what if we do a World War II game where like you can be an orc? Is that like, would that be acceptable?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a big part of our challenge with gaming Inuyasha, like just with the two hosts we have here, is how do we make this not so anime?
Right. Or at least, you know, appealing to people like ourselves who mm-hmm. would maybe be turned off by an anime style. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm so fond of the setting, but not of the characters, because I find the setting and the creatures, the demons, to be really interesting a lot of the time. But the larger plot line is very character driven, and that's why I have such a hard time kind of getting into the actual show.
Yes, these characters are the biggest parts of the code to crack for sure. And so let's get to talking about characters with a round of I'd Play That. So as our guest, as my guest, you are first for I'd Play That. So who in this giant cast of eligible characters would you like to play?
Well, if you listen to the last episode, you probably already know the answer to this question, because I don't like any of these characters with one enormous exception, and that is the Demon Slayer Sango, who I am just so into. I mean, how could you turn down a character who has an extremely tragic and pathos-laden backstory that you can really build off of, and in addition to that, is a fucking demon hunter who wields a gigantic boomerang and rides around on an enormous badass cat with fire on its paws. And like,
it's so fantastic. This is like the epitome of get you a PC who can do both. Like, this is such a great character, but she's also like, yeah, definitely the biggest badass and like anime special effects character in the protagonist group.
Yeah, I would play the hell out of her. She is so cool, and like there are really certain elements of anime that I think that even though I think I'll find it silly, I actually really love it. And like the gigantic boomerang is just one of those things. I don't know why I love it so much. I don't know why I don't just lump it off into like, oh, crazy anime shit. Like, you know, this guy over here has a fucking black hole in his hand. Like, you know, that's weird. That's not, like, badass to me. That's just bizarre. But the giant boomerang, you know, absolutely. I am here for that.
But to go back to the pro wrestling analogy, I think that there's a line that you cross into absurdity where it becomes awesome again. It's like, you know, okay, maybe I don't need to see another, you know, STF, like a Cena's STF, because it's too loose, right? So it's not believable.
Right.
But the Iron Claw, absolutely, I'll take an Iron Claw. You know, it's like with the extra leverage on the wrist, like Matt Classic style. Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I think that the boomerang it's like a big sword is almost plausible. Like that's way too big to swing. And that's a problem because right. If you could, then it would be damaging. But a giant boomerang, there's no part of that works. And so I think it comes back around.
I see what no you did there. Intended. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm totally up for Sango. She's on the short list for I'd Play That for me for sure. And I think she's an example of a character who, like, if she's what you like in this show, that would even drag the PC group in a different direction. Because the way that she hunts demons is so different from what the other characters do.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed her little bit at the beginning of episode 28, where she's like, she set up this thing, like, they have basically this demon rat problem. And so she set up her poison gas. Inuyasha's at a safe distance. Kagome's got a gas mask on and is, like, using some bellows to, like, blow the poison gas into the building to get the demon out. Like, I would like hunting demons that way. It's very different from charging in with your magic sword.
Right. And there's so much you can do with her as a character, too. Sango is a woman who, you know, starts off being extremely good at what she does, but is also very kind of carefree and a really charming person. And she's been really, you know, traumatized in a lot of ways by what happened to her father and her brother and, you know, the rest of her village. So... Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to get out of there in terms of, you know, how to play the character. Can she rediscover these lost elements of herself that have kind of gone by the wayside now that she's, you know, and again, I'm making assumptions because she doesn't get a lot of time in the first season. She, mm-hmm. Like I said, she comes in fourth episode from the end. So I don't know if they do this with her in the rest of the show or not. But if I were playing season one Sango, I would want to kind of take her through a story arc that might culminate in her kind of trying to rediscover aspects of her character and her personality that she's having a hard time accessing as a result of what happened. And I think that's a lot more interesting than, you know, Inuyasha wants to become a full demon, but he really shouldn't.
Yeah, and there are interesting places for that to go, but they're less suggested because one of the things about the difference between like Sango and Inuyasha is that we meet Inuyasha really after his moment of vulnerability, when he is at his most sort of like calloused.
Mm-hmm.
And so we only gradually sort of get hints that there's something more to him. I think the more effective thing, and this is true at the table as well, because as we'll discuss, I think one of the problems with Inuyasha is that there are depths to that character that don't come out often enough for him to be an enjoyable character to watch. And that can easily happen in role-playing. With Sango, instead, what you have is you have her introduced sort of just before her moment of greatest vulnerability so that we see her go through that. And so when we see her in a more hardened state later, we're keeping firmly in mind, like, okay, she used to be this. Now she's going through a hard time. Yeah. And even though we don't actually see, because we only watched the first season, we don't see her journey upward, that's implicit in our minds because we've already seen the fall instead of just meeting her in her fallen state.
I thought I read somewhere that she ends up marrying the lecherous monk, which made me very sad, but I'm just going to headcanon that right out of my brain.
Speaking of, I'm going to choose Miroku for I'd play that. Let me first preface this by saying that I think grabbing people in a sexual fashion against their will is gross. I don't think it is a charming character trait, and I think that it does a lot to ruin the character's tone. It's one of those things that really needed to be localized out of existence, because putting aside what I think is the objective moral issue with groping women, from the perspective of like cultural palatability, I think you cannot really have a lighthearted character who grabs teenagers' boobs all the time.
I would agree with that.
In America. It works in Japan culturally. Whether it should or not is a discussion for a more serious podcast.
Right.
But I do think that I like the character that they were going for with Miroku. And I like a lot of other aspects of his character. I enjoy the like slick con man type of character. And I also enjoy playing like a cleric. I think this is a great combination of those two. And when you also have underlying that, a fact that this is a character who's like kind of grappling with mortality. I mean, his death is more or less imminent, especially after that wild night where he woke up with a stretched out wind tunnel. You know, he is...
I'm never going to not laugh at that.
He is facing down doom. And so...
Doom!
The fact that he is doing all this sort of defensively, like both his priestly aspect and his like comedic kind of lecherous aspect are defenses against the fact that he's dealing with death. There's something to develop there. And I can deal with the womanizing as long as it's consensual. You know, it's a big feudal Japan. I'm sure he can find lots of ladies who are either receptive to his flirtation or will turn him down comedically without getting into, actual sexual assault. And I think that would not be injurious to the character at all. I think you could still play him basically as conceived. And, he's got a cool special attack. He fights with a staff that's cool. He's slick. I don't know. I enjoy Miroku. And I think he would lend himself to this kind of storytelling because he does have something about him to discover. You know, he can be in funny scenes, but there's also some traction. Unlike Shippo, who I think they kind of forgot to give him another level.
Yeah. Yeah, Miroku was actually, like, probably my second choice. It's weird, though, because I feel like there's, like, a dissonance between various aspects of his character, because there are times when he comes off as just, like, this really wise, really down-to-earth, kind of like, he's a complement to Inuyasha's kind of constant anger and bitterness, and Kagome's head in the clouds, maybe not head in the clouds, but, you know, she is played comedically for being clueless a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And she's not the most adept person in the world. So, you know, Inuyasha's very adept, but he's also a loose cannon. So you've got him and Kagome and Shippo, who's all comedy. And Miroku comes off frequently as kind of a stabilizing character. You know, the straight man, who is very, you know, at times almost solemn. And then, you know, he turns around and he gropes women and he steals shit from everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's so bizarre to me. I don't know. There's a dissonance in my mind about who the character is. And I feel like that kind of hurts it for me. Because I would want to play him the more straight monk with the hand cannon, you know what I mean? With the black hole in his palm, without the lecherousness and the, you know, just blatant theft that everybody just kind of laughs off and never addresses.
It's true. I mean, he is a, I don't want to say that he's morally complex, but I think that he is unusual in his like moral position in the story, because he represents a different kind of virtue. Like we see that when they discuss the Shikan Jewel, he sort of represents courage.
Mm-hmm.
I almost see him as a character with like a deep amoral serenity that comes from grappling with death. And that's interesting.
I can see that.
To me to play. Like he seems like the sort of character who is dealing with such big things that whereas a regular person might think twice about stealing something, he's just like, you know, what the hell? You know, like,
yeah.
It's, you only live once. It's not going to last that long. Yeah, I'm going to make out with this girl, even though I probably shouldn't. Yeah, I'm going to steal this thing. And, you know, but he still kind of does the right thing on a large scale and allows himself these kind of transgressions. And again, when that verges into sexual assault, we've got a problem with the character and it ruins the comedy. But if it doesn't, then that works for me. I think that would be fun to play.
Yeah.
I would be happy to play the contradiction.
I think if you can stitch that together into a central and really, you know, kind of well-understood character, that would be a lot of fun to play, as long as you avoided the pitfalls that you mentioned earlier.
I'll say that while we may not like these characters a lot, they all feel like they could be PCs for somebody who does like them.
This whole show lends itself really well to gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because this is a party by the end.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Inuyasha, who's your kind of berserker warrior, right? Miroku, who's your monk. You've got Sango, who is your, I think, probably less berserker warrior, more assassin-y in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Shippo, who is your kind of thief or illusionist character. Rogue, perhaps, in the more modern parlance. I don't know where Kagome fits in there, but, you know, maybe she can be a really shitty ranger.
Well, Big Eyes Small Mouth D20 has a student class, so
right,
just homebrew that on it.
Yeah. But yeah, it lends itself really well to building gaming characters out of these people, because it is a party setting. It's very, very, it's very D&D.
It's true. It has that aspect sometimes when you watch anime that involves like fantastical, like feudal Japan. You get this sense of like, okay, these are basically just adventurers wandering the countryside fighting monsters, so that you can't really get closer to gaming than that.
Yeah, and I think that contributed a lot to my appreciation of the season a little bit more as it went along, was because I tend to really enjoy stories about groups of companions, you know, especially in a fantasy setting. So that kind of got me a little bit more the more I watched.
I don't think I dislike these characters quite as much as you did. I think that sometimes they're infuriating. Like, Kagome and Inuyasha particularly are a couple I do not enjoy watching, and partly that is because the trajectory of their relationship is so clear right from the beginning that I kind of want them to like hurry up and grow up and just like do something I didn't expect.
Yeah, and man, the voice acting doesn't help in the dub.
That is true, and I think that is interrelated to like the content of what they have to say, though, because I think, for example, Inuyasha's voice acting is fine when Inuyasha is being a comedic jerk. And when the comedy is good, the voice acting works for that. But I don't think that it works with the heavy lifting that character's meant to do with like the romance plot or like sort of like the epic, like the stuff dealing with Tetsuya. The character voice seems out of place. And that's sort of my problem, is the interaction between character and plot, because I think this show is at its best when we're seeing beneath the surface of the characters into like their group dynamics, and that's compelling, and it's happening like against a backdrop that allows them to express their relationship through action. I think the show is at its worst when it, and this is a problem we talked about way back in our Disney episode on Black Cauldron, when it puts genre convention in center stage as though we're supposed to care about it. I have no interest in the Chosen One's quest for the magic sword,
right,
as a main course. Like, I know how that goes. So, you know, if you're going to have that, have it as a shaping element, and then give me an interesting character having an interesting emotional experience that I can't predict. And when the show fails to do that, then I kind of fall off of it.
Yeah, and you know, it suffers from being in many ways kind of a traditional plot, as you mentioned, which with not a lot of twists and turns, not a lot of subverted expectations, which is one of the reasons I love Sango so much.
It's true. Sango is really cool, and I think if you're looking at it from a gaming perspective, I think players often don't realize how much they can do to make fun in a formulaic plot if they create a group with an eye toward group dynamics, which is too rarely done. I think even when you do what is now very conventional and have like the character creation session, you know, I'm glad that we're kind of out of the bad old days where everybody creates their characters separately and then comes to the table and the GM's expected to stitch them together. Even so, very often people end up creating characters to sort of like fill a mechanical niche or whatever. Or just like, let's all create something different, which are great steps in the right direction. But creating characters who can like carry a scene together just through group dynamics, that is what will make your generic D&D campaign into fun. And this show sometimes accomplishes that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hell. Don't tell Dan, but I'm now, like, really considering Songo for Extraordinary League. I think that might be a lot of fun.
You should go for it. I was actually thinking about that when you were talking about Songo. Like, I love characters like that. I love the characters who have to, like, prep combat. And I think, incidentally, that Songo is the ranger in this group. Because she's got the animal companion.
Oh, that's a good point.
She uses the gas. She's got, like, her gear. And she's also got, like, a setting tie-in, which is, to me, is the difference between a fighter and a ranger.
Mm.
A ranger is a fighter who gives a damn about the setting.
Oh, shit. She has a racial enemy, too.
A racial enemy. Yeah, that's true.
Demons, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the good racial enemies to have as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So what would you do? What do you think you need for character creation? Like, if you're playing Inuyasha, what's on your character sheet?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the system in a lot of ways. So, like, when you say what's on the character sheet?
Like, let's say we're playing D&D 5e Inuyasha.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got a lot of information about, like, exactly what can Tetsaiga do is going to be in the equipment part. We're going to have stats for each character of, like, how strong they are, how fast they are, etc. And then, really, all we're going to have in terms of their relationships is, like, their bonds are going to be written, like, a couple little sentences about how this character relates to this character. Compare that to a game like, and this is a weird poll, but, like, Dogs in the Vineyard. If we were playing, you know, Inuyasha, Dogs in the Vineyard, then we've got character sheets that have, like, basically four shared stats among the characters, and then a lot of freeform stuff about our relationships to each other and special places and, you know, equipment related to the setting. But it's going to be much more character driven.
Can I just say that the fact that you are aware of Dogs in the Vineyard makes me so happy inside.
It's such a fantastic game. I love Dogs in the Vineyard. Because I'm a GM who likes to make characters miserable, and I really need a game that's built for that.
I love those abstract games.
Yeah. But, like, what do you think would suit Inuyasha? Would you rather have a character sheet full of, like, relationships and freeform traits, or do you think this is one that would benefit from, like, okay, what is our strength? What is Inuyasha's strength versus Kagome's strength, etc.?
You know, as much as I said earlier that the party dynamic, you know, reminds me of D&D. But I don't think Inuyasha would work very well as a in the D&D system. Strictly in terms of what the characters can do, everybody, and this is kind of common of anime, everybody has a very specific and very unique ability, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can't just say, well, you know, Inuyasha has the, you know, the cleave feat or whatever. Right. Because anyone can take that. So you want a system where these powers and these abilities are really unique to the characters. You don't want just anyone to be able to make a wind tunnel, you know?
Right.
So mechanically, it probably lends itself better to something like Savage Worlds or God help me, even Palladium. But even better would probably be, you know, I think something like Dogs in the Vineyard, something like you know, Primetime Adventures, where the player gets to say, okay, here's a word or a phrase, and that's what my character can do.
Yeah, more freeform, but still connected to the physical reality of the world, as opposed to being focused on, like, okay, as Kagome, the main thing on my character sheet is that I love Inuyasha.
Right.
Instead, it's like, my thing is, I'm a student from the modern world. That sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I tend to think that everything based on a TV show should be played in Primetime Adventures, because Primetime Adventures is so thoroughly geared toward making the game feel like an episodic television program. But yeah, some of those games that force you to flesh out what your relationships are with the other characters, because that's a huge part of this show, and I think probably more important than how you kill monsters and how effective you are at doing it. So, yeah, I think something like those... Savage Worlds would probably be good as long as you kind of force the players to develop their relationships. I mean, when we used to play D&D, we got around that the problem of there being no relationship mechanic by simply forcing people to come up with backgrounds for their characters and you know, asking them to please get together and interweave them and explain why their characters are journeying together. That's just a thing that we did. But I really appreciate something along the lines of, like, In This Wicked Age, which I don't know if you ever played that, but it's I've actually never gotten the chance to play it myself, but the character creation dynamic is so bizarre, and it actually forces you to randomly draw setting and story elements and then choose a character from the ones that came up and flush them out from then. It's a very abstract game. But yeah, I think something much more freeform that forces you to focus on character elements as opposed to GURPS-esque number crunching.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't go in the super crunchy direction. I think that you're getting at a really interesting divergence there, or a potential problem with synecdoche between the two different things that character creation is meant to do. Because character creation, simultaneously, it forces you to go through a process that will produce the kind of character you want to play. But it also creates the mechanical expression of the character that will be necessary to navigate through the scenes in the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, every character needs to roll for con. And for how many characters is that an important step in crafting the character you want to play? Almost none. But you need con to play the scenes.
Right.
And I think that Inuyasha is in a weird space to show that those two things are really separate tasks, because you really need two different things. I think that to play through the scenes of an Inuyasha episode, you primarily need to know about your special attack. You need to know about your physical attributes. You know, you got to get your wind tunnel sorted out and figure out exactly how far it can stretch, right?
Absolutely.
so that's why I'm suggesting Fatal. No, I think that's the stuff you need for the scenes. But to make the actual campaign interesting, you need to really go through the hoops of, like, who am I? Why am I that way? How do I feel about these people? What am I hiding? Much more in the vein of, like, you know, A Dirty World, or, like, you know, Burning Wheel or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I would be, as you say, like, if that's an easy fix, you just need to add an extra step that is in some cases non-mechanical to character creation. But I would definitely not let an Inuyasha character hit the table with no depth of character, who is just powers. Because while you'll be fine on the scene level, I think you're going to make the campaign fall flat.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And whether that needs a mechanical expression, I don't know.
Even Shippo has some stuff going on. Not much, but...
Let's get to the setting. What parts of this setting did you find, like, compelling or that would be important to adapt?
That's an interesting choice. I mean, obviously the setting is feudal Japan, but it doesn't have to be. Like, if you wanted to do an Inuyasha-style campaign, I think the Japanese element does not necessarily need to be there. But I think, like, it'd be interesting to do more with the connection, more than they do, with the well connecting feudal Japan and the modern era. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much I would want to play in that game, but you could do interesting things with it. And, you know, obviously I find the Demon Slayer village really compelling before it gets burned to the ground. but it's interesting because all the places they go in Inuyasha seem to be very disconnected in a lot of ways. Like, it's like, okay, you know, we've arrived in this town where they worship a water god. No one else worships a water god. And right. These people don't really know anything about anyone else who don't worship a water god, but these people worship a water god. It's episodic to a fault, I would say.
Yeah, it's very much in the vein of, like, a Star Trek or something like that, where it's like, we have our setting as protagonists, but that doesn't really impact, like, that's just sort of an engine for little mini settings, little micro settings that we go to from episode to episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the NPCs within each place are more or less a closed system. You know, it's like us and the villain, and then everybody else just kind of, like, lives in their little town and, like, has their one thing that their town is about. I think that can work fine for gaming, but again, it is in this vein of formulaic storytelling that is just a palette for us to do character stuff on and have cool fights. Wouldn't go looking for anything more than that. I think that maybe for feel, I would definitely want to do this Warring States period if I'm playing Inuyasha. I want the monsters from this period, but I also want the openness of it. Like, I want there not to be skyscrapers, you know? I want it to be trees instead of city streets.
Yeah.
I kind of want the space. Like, I feel like this is a more colorful version of that vast expanse of craters and boulders in Dragon Ball Z where all the fights seem to happen. this is just, like, space for us to have, like, monster fights and mysterious events in the woods and things like that. And I do like those events and those monsters, therefore I kind of need this place, right?
I think the other problem with trying to do this in any sort of kind of urban or constricted environment is that one of the things I like about Inuyasha is that there's no real explanation for why there are all these demons around and why there are so many different kinds. And I think that the older, more rural setting really lends itself well to that, because you've preserved this idea that the world is a mysterious, terrifying place. And, you know, yeah, maybe there is a crow who goes into people's bodies and controls them, you know, like, mm-hmm. So Yeah, I would totally agree with you on that. I think this is fundamentally a fantasy campaign. I don't think you could switch that genre at all and still maintain, still stay true to the spirit of the anime.
Yeah, you want that space, and then the specifics that are put in that space are more dispensable. Like, I love the Demon Hunter Village. If you don't, this would absolutely still be Inuyasha without it.
Yeah.
Likewise, you don't need the Shikon Jewel unless you find it useful for your story. You know, all the individual stuff that they kind of put in there. I think it would be more in the spirit of the show, actually, to insert your own stuff that's specific to your characters. Because one of the things I like about this is that these characters all get like plenty of setting real estate to bring in. You know, each character has stuff attached to them that they bring into it. That really reminds me of like campaign creation in something like, Fate, or like specifically Dresden Files, where part of character creation is, okay, now bring in all your shit. Like, where are the places connected to your character?
Right.
The NPCs connected to your character.
Yeah, the Fate system might really work for this in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I think that for people who are fans of the show, there could be some value in using these specific elements, but I would just warn against using them in quite the predictable plot load-bearing way that the show does, because I think even for fans, that's more frustrating at tabletop than it is in a TV show. Like, I don't want to be put into a situation where there's only one conceivable outcome as a player. Like, it's bad enough to watch it on TV, but I cannot emphasize enough how much I do not want to deal with Sesshomaru's bullshit at the table. You know, I know everything here can only end in one way, and we're just inevitably driving toward it. That's bad D&D.
Oh, it's a huge sticky point for you.
Yeah,
the Sesshomaru really bullshit problem.
And because it's just emblematic to me of everything wrong with this series.
Yeah.
And how, like, when I think about having a bad time playing Inuyasha, that's what's happening. It's like, I'm sitting there, I've got Moroku, and I'm like, okay, you know, let me go try to, like, hit on these ladies, and let me, you know, exercise some demons, like, shit gets serious, and then my staff comes out. Let me, you know, act like
staff
I'm giving wise...
right out of the wind tunnel, yep.
Yeah. I'm going to give wise spiritual counsel to Kagome, and then turn it into a pickup line at the end, and then she's going to, like, slap me. Great, that's all fun stuff that I can do with Moroku. And instead, I'm sitting here listening to the GM trying to do his cool guy voice, brushing his hair out of his face and being like, of course you are far beneath my concern, but nonetheless, I will deign to spend some time kicking your asses. And then,
right,
you know, and then it's like, okay, but then who can draw the magic sword? And then what are we going to do? And it's like, all this is like, it's a foregone conclusion. I know, just like, let me get to the bar. Let me get my shit in, right?
Yeah, and like, you know, and part of the issue with that, I think a huge reason is that, you know, the name of this show is Inuyasha. It is named after one of the characters. And the name of your campaign should not be the name of one of your characters.
Yes, I've played in that campaign, and let me tell you, it's no fun.
Yeah, so, you know, you don't want to have, like, a bunch of character-specific plots going on, because then nobody else is having any fun, and everybody's going to resent that guy. One of the things that I did do when I was doing the background campaign, where I asked my players to come back with background, is I said, look, the more you want the game to focus on you, the more detailed your background better be. Because if you give me stuff to work with, then I'll work it into the plot. And the result was that everybody came back with all this shit. And I was like, well, crap, I have enough stories for 5 years with this. I think the, again, just to real quick go back to Primetime Adventures, I think Primetime Adventures does a really great job of managing that from a mechanical standpoint. So it's actually a game designed to create campaigns with a beginning and an end. So, like, at the beginning of the game, you'll say, okay, this game is going to last 7 sessions, right? And then you'll have, like, little numbers. So there'll be these little bubbles, and 3 of them will say 1, and 3 of them will say 2, and then, like, 1 of them will say 3 or something like that, right? And you basically assign, like, which week you want these. So if that week you're number 3, then that means the story is going to revolve primarily around you. If that week you're number 1, then you're going to be a bit more of a bit player. And it's a really interesting mechanical way of ensuring that everybody gets their time to shine over the course of the story. But yeah, in terms of avoiding the Sesshomaru bullshit problem, I think a lot of that comes down to just making sure everybody gets a piece of the spotlight. Yeah. And that you're not just crafting a bunch of NPCs who are all the half-brothers of one character.
Definitely. It's a matter of focus, and it's a matter of, like, finding, like, where the fun and the interest is, as always. I think that's sort of, like, the step between the beginner and the intermediate GM is the ability to identify what is just structural and necessary, and where is the actual fun in this, and making sure that you're getting to that fun. And that's where you have, like, okay, if we're chasing gem shards, That's as may be. That's fine. But it's not interesting. Therefore, we're not going to do a week of stories about it.
Right.
We're only going to use it to the extent that it gets us to the fun stuff. So we talked a little last time about our kind of our issues with the treatment of women in the show and Kagome in particular. Normally, we do a gritty reboot segment. Here, I don't think that's necessary because this is not a Saturday morning cartoon. We talked a little about how it's a little strange. It's not really for kids as much as it does not seem very adult either.
That's pretty gritty.
Yeah. So what I'd maybe like to do instead, since I think this is a show that we both had some issues with, is just talk a little about like what are the main things that would need solving to bring this to tabletop in terms of the non-mechanical content. So not like, you know, how do you adapt Tetsaiga's power level to a game, but like, how do you address our big problems with this show, including things like the treatment of women? So as a GM, let's bring back our old friend, the GM killer. Okay. He's stalking you. He's got a gun to your head. He's forcing you to run an Inuyasha campaign. Okay. What would you do about this gender bullshit to make it a palatable game for you to run?
The biggest problem for me is the way Kagome is presented as a character and the way other characters react to her. So in a certain sense, it's tell your players not to be asshats.
Okay.
You know, but beyond that, I just think it's a matter of not grounding your story in these really, you know, kind of traditionalist tropes. You know, you want to tell your story about the gem, you know, the Shaikon jewel and its pieces being scattered and all these demons finding them. That's fine. Like, that's all well and good. You can do that. But the part that I don't think you need is the Inuyasha Kikyo connection. I think that element can be taken out. And I think that you can lose some of the kind of traditional Japanese story crutches. That sounds really, hostile. But your characters don't need to be the resurrected, you know, teenage versions of your other character's former love interest. Do you know what I mean? Like, am I explaining this right? I think I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think you're right that the characters would have a lot to do with it. I'll say that I play with people that I wouldn't be too worried about them dragging in that stuff. But what I would be more concerned about is the way that the plot feeds into it. And I think you're right that a lot of storytelling conventions go to giving this show sort of the unfortunate aspects that it has, particularly the emphasis on female characters being in a position as like necessary purifiers to facilitate male action. There's almost a fairy tale aspect of like this perfect girl of perfect, unbelievable virtue who somehow manages to convert evil to good. The fact that that's so consistently attached to women, I think, can tend to reduce the role of women in the show to a stereotype in a way that really is not done with the male characters. We talked about, you know, Moroku. Moroku is, in some sense, an archetype on the surface, but he has another level. And while I think Kagome has another level as a character, as a functional part of the story, she really does not. We know immediately from her, like, purifying role, like her purifying magic, that that is her thing. That is what she does. All you have to do, in my mind, is put another level on that. It reminds me of, this was done really well, I think, in Luke Cage, where, like, Reva is in that role of, like, the woman, the professional woman who comes in from outside and, like, redeems this ex-con. But, spoilers for Luke Cage, she's later revealed not to be quite what he thought she was, because she's a human being, not, like, an agent of redemption for the male lead.
Right. I think that the thing that I would do most of all if I was running an Inuyasha game would be to maybe set up the same things and then subvert them, which is, yes, I think, is what the show does not do. But yeah, Kikyo, I think, in particular, is, you know, really problematic because her entire role in the story is as the purifier of the jewel. But then, you know, that's a metaphor. That's a metaphor for her being the purifier of Inuyasha. If Inuyasha can get together with her and make her love him, then she can make him human again. She can, you know, purify the demon part of his essence, his soul, or whatever. You know, that's what she's there to do. And the fact that Kagome is the reincarnated version of that, who also ends up falling for Inuyasha, means that that's what she's there to do. And again, it's a main character problem, right? Inuyasha is our main, and these women are there to kind of facilitate his character arc. So you can do it a different way by simply, you know, making sure that women are not in support roles and in, you know, kind of these really standard, you know, I'm going to be the vessel for a male character's storyline. And it's really easy. You know what I mean? All you have to do is not fall into these traps that the writers of Inuyasha clearly did, if they even tried to avoid them, which I really kind of doubt.
I don't think that they did. I think that it was enough for them to develop the psychology of Kagome to the extent that they did, and they didn't feel the need to take her role out of the realm of the sort of female up on a pedestal who kind of pulls Inuyasha into being a civilized hero instead of a savage.
Right.
Which is very tropey. And I don't think a character is likely to lapse into that, but I think that if you try to tell this kind of story with these tropes, the plot will drive the character that way, because if you're Kagome and your only superpower is purifying Inuyasha's soul so that he can be a badass, then that's what you're going to do.
And, yeah, you know, I would set up that character and have an NPC that's like the purifying female character that, like, oh, if you can get me, you know, the jewel, then, like, I will purify it, and have that be the whole goal of the campaign, and then at the end have them give her the jewel and then have her, like, turn out to be a demon all along.
Yeah. Or, I mean, you can also have, you know, an internal struggle. Like, actually, a better example of this would maybe be to stick with anime, to go over to Sailor Moon, where you've got characters who have very sort of archetypal roles in, like, saving the world and their relationships and everything. But because the female characters are our viewpoint characters and their emotional journey is our main focus, they actually do have, like, lapses. Like, all the women in that show, you know, with few exceptions, are legitimate human beings who are not defined by their cosmological role in the setting.
Hmm.
And so, like, you can be the avatar of, like, salvific purity and yet have a lapse and have to deal with, like, the fact that you are a human and not just a symbolic figure.
Right.
And you have to reconcile those things. It would be much more interesting if Kagome actually were, you know, like, had to deal with her own shit before she could be of any use to Inuyasha. And if it turned out that, you know, we could focus more on the growing she has to do for herself, in addition to what she can do for Inuyasha, which is, like, more of a compelling way to put a relationship together in fiction as in real life, is to think of it as two people who can be good for each other and are striving to do so, rather than, you know, like, male and female are the two halves of a complete person, and we gotta, you know, pull it together. So,
which has its own issues.
My job is throwing punches, and your job is being decent, and together we can function in society.
Right, yeah, that's shit to avoid, and I think that, you know, it's really easy to do. Just make your characters actual characters instead of symbolic stand-ins for abstract concepts, basically.
To cap off this section with something a little bit lighter, I'll say that a big part of what turns me off about Inuyasha is all of the little kind of anime stuff. I actually went and checked in my copy of Big Eyes, Small Mouth to look at, like, okay, here's the primer on anime tropes. And it basically reads like a plot synopsis of an episode of Inuyasha. This show is everything about anime. And I think a big part of what would dissuade me from playing it would be those things. There's something about this indefinable tone of anime. I can't quite put my finger on it, but, like, sometimes I'm getting into the characters having their little, like, discussions and their group dynamics. But it's, like, sometimes, like, oh, the control necklace where Kagome says sit.
Yeah.
It is so hokey. It so much undercuts any chance I have to take these characters seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And the comedy just does not play well in a lot of cases, I don't think. You know, it's again, maybe it's a cultural thing, maybe it's a this show is old thing, maybe mm-hmm. it's both, but watching it, you know, in America in 2017, it's like, man, these jokes do not land at all.
It's stuff that seems inauthentic and like it's meant for, it's sort of like meta humor aimed at the anime audience as opposed to things that grow organically out of character, which I think are a little more evergreen. Like, I will say one thing I laughed at and that I would definitely use as a character trait for, like, a rowdy PC is how from time to time, he did this to Shippo and he also did it to that kid in episode 27, the season finale. Sometimes when Inuyasha thinks somebody needs to be put in their place, he just grabs them and starts very dispassionately punching the top of their head. I enjoy that. I think that if you know, that is sort of like chaotic neutral, which I have a secret sympathy for.
Sure, okay.
Yeah. And I'm into that, but I think that partly is because, like, that's who Inuyasha is. it's a little hokey, it's a little anime flavored, but I believe he'll do that.
Yeah, that's legit.
That works for me, but I don't know. Yeah. I think that just the anime feel coming off of this show, the anime stink coming off of it, if you could somehow get rid of that, I would be much more amenable to playing this basic idea, these characters, this setting.
Yeah, also give us a hint that there's a villain before episode 20.
That would be nice.
Or whatever.
I liked Naraku once he showed up, but I did think that it was a little bit late. That's true.
I will say that the reveal of him being the Lord dude at the castle where Sango tried to kill that spider was like pretty much the only time in the show that I was like, oh, it's him, you know? But yeah, this show was like obviously designed to go a long time.
Yeah.
And I think in a game there at least should be some end in sight.
That's true. Although, you know, interestingly, Takahashi said that she did not have the ending of Inuyasha in mind when she started writing it, and that's her way of approaching her work. She waits for it to, you know, like be serialized and kind of to find the ending for a while before she plans it. I think that's a great idea for role playing. I think that while it's good for campaigns to have endings, if they're going to be longer than a few sessions, it's best not to plan that ending until you've really got, you know,
I'm not saying plan the ending beforehand, but, you know, just like be advised, you're not going to have 7 years to yeah. finish out all your shit.
It's true. Yeah, a little more forward motion can help a lot. And just like if you're going to have revelations, that's one thing place where this show really falls down is revelations of things that aren't really revelations if you understand anime at all. And I find that to be a problem that a lot of anime has. And again, I don't know if that is like cultural or what, but there's an awful lot of what are supposed to be big shocking turns that are like absolutely stock anime plots.
Yeah.
A lot of this is the, of course we're doing it because it's anime. If you could just take that one thing out, because I think there's a lot of like sort of consequence-free stuff that happens among what is otherwise an interesting character dynamic that is just like, of course we do this because it's anime, like the lecherous priest who gropes the girls.
Right. Or like, you know, the reveal that, you know, the whole damn thing started over a misunderstanding because, you know, Kikyo and Inuyasha both thought the other had turned on them because some dude was manipulating things behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. We're surrounded by demons, but then the true power of the magic sword is unleashed, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I would just as soon skip it. Because it makes things feel consequence free. When you do things like that in a game too often, like the true power of the sword being revealed, what that communicates to the players is don't pay attention to the reality of the fiction because right. we're operating on narrative logic. So
well, don't forget, not just the true power of the sword, the true power of the sword's sheath.
That's true.
Which is also awesome.
That definitely smacks of a situation where the GM had in his notes like, and then the true power of the Tetsuga will be revealed. And then the first thing that happens in the fight is Inuyasha's like, I f***ing throw this sword at him across the room. And the GM's like, oh shit. Well, fortunately, right. you've got a magic sheath.
Yeah. Good thing. A little flea guy shows up to tell you all about it.
So let's go to our final stuff. Pros of gaming Inuyasha.
Pros of gaming Inuyasha, I think it allows you for a lot of creativity, and it allows you to really do some cool stuff that would be considered not taboo, but kind of like, you know, unwelcome in other games. You know, you could come up with a hair demon and it would be cool.
Yeah, stuff that would be out of place elsewhere.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah, I think that the Sengoku period is one that maybe has not been used as much in gaming as it could be. It really lends its like it's a different flavor of setting that provides a lot of the functionality of generic pseudo medieval fantasy bullshit. So maybe like for your next D&D campaign, we're just going to be a bunch of murder hobos, you know,
make it the
Sengoku period just for a change. Other than that, I also think, yeah, like the cool monsters are great. And the little bit of setting detail that we get on how demons work could go a long way toward making a monster of the week feel a little less random. Oftentimes you run into this like a campaign that is basically a trip through the monster manual. And part of the problem with that is that there's no underlying like logic or system at all to the monsters in the monster manual. and turning it into demons who sort of have like their own, there is a something like a consistent demonology in this show, even though there's plenty of room for original creations, could make it feel more like you're really in a story and not just a tour of monsters.
Sure. Yeah.
How about cons?
Ooh, anime.
Okay.
The main con of playing Yuyasha is that you're just going to, like you were talking about, there's going to be a real temptation to feel married to a certain kind of aesthetic in terms of your storytelling, and I just don't think you need to do that. I think that you can take the good elements of it and take out the things that just really scream of stuff that doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that the relative shallowness of the setting is also a problem. It's one of those series where I think it could be hard to imagine how to do something different from this because it's so tied up to the characters and there's not very much, like there's not a lot of world happening outside these characters' lives.
Yeah, there's not a lot of interconnection between the various places they go, as I think we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of like, okay, now you're in this place. And I think in terms of world building, it doesn't do a good job because it didn't care.
Yes. It is purely about these characters and what they're up to, and the setting is built only to the extent that it supports that. And sometimes when that happens in a story, it's we talked about this in back in Disney with like Beauty and the Beast. It's very difficult to imagine how to game that if you're not playing this specific love story.
Right.
Because there's nothing else kind of compelling out there. Whereas there are plenty of stories that are, you know, like Star Wars is the great example of this, highly focused on their characters, but yet so many things are introduced that immediately it pops to mind like, oh, I could create other characters who are doing these other things.
Absolutely.
You know, it automatically gives birth to a world. And Inuyasha is not that. I do think also that the reliance upon a romance that is highly predictable and in many ways irritating.
Not to mention dubious.
Yeah, it's hard to adapt because I feel like it's almost not going to feel like Inuyasha if you don't have a romance at the center of it. But you can't really do this romance. And if you try to create another one, it's still not going to feel like this one unless it's equally terrible characters. So you're kind of in a predicament there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, ultimately you're going to have to strike a balance between making this an Inuyasha game and making this a good game.
Yes.
You know, which is, you know, I think there's a line to walk there. I just think it's kind of thin.
I would agree with that. This would be one of those that I'd maybe recommend more for a spinoff or like a crossover. Like, I'm excited about the idea of Songo and Extraordinary League. That sounds awesome to me. And
right?
I think this, if I were going to game Inuyasha, this would be an example where I would maybe use it as a juncture in a feng shui game or use it as like bring in another anime that has something different to bring to the table and then cross it over with Inuyasha, something like that, just to like shake out of what could be like the stultifying structure of this and let players and GM alike feel free to do something good instead of sticking to what Inuyasha did.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I think we can agree that this is gameable.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
And we talked a little about system recommendations earlier. What would be your top picks after kind of what we sorted out in characters and setting? What two or three games do you think you would probably pick to play this?
If I was going more traditional, then I would go with Savage Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Savage Worlds is a little bit more flexible, and while you have like specific edges and flaws that anyone can get, you can also, it's very easy to come up with new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you can specify, like you might have an edge that's like powerful weapon with a flaw that's, you know, like will also kill you someday.
Right.
You know, but you can, when you cobble together those things, it's really easy to come up with really unique powers. So Savage Worlds would work really well for that. If you're looking for, you know, if you have players that don't want to go too far outside the box of traditional gaming systems, the more I think about it, the more, like, the less I think Dresden and the Fate system would work for this, just because that is so tied into setting, and it would be really hard to do that with Inuyasha characters. Because the Inuyasha setting is so thin. But then again, if you want to expand it and kind of make the Inuyasha setting your own and come up with an actual, you know, articulated, integrated world, then by all means, I think Fate would be fun. But if you're willing to think outside the box a little bit, then I think something like Dogs in the Vineyard or Primetime Adventures would probably be the ideal system for this kind of thing.
I don't know if I'd go quite that free form. I think that it would work well for what this show does best. But for what this show does most often, and as you were saying earlier, like the fights are not the important part of the show, but they are the spine of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would definitely want there to be system content there to cover those fights and make them interesting.
That's a good point.
So I would tend to... Actually, Big Eyes Small Mouth is, you know, it's an old game at this point, but it is intended for very generic anime, and this is a very generic anime. It has all the things like, you know, build your special attack with point buy. You know, it has a soul, body, and mind tri-stat as its core so that you've got, like, the smart character, the soul-infused, you know, character, like, which is going to be your Kagome, then the strength, and those things all balance for combat value, so people are balanced in combat. Yeah, I think it is kind of the right balance of crunch versus fluff. It's not quite freeform enough for my tastes here, but I think that the material it does have is so suited to the anime, to anime tropes, that you wouldn't need as much freeform as you would in other systems, because a lot of the stuff about these characters is like on tables in Big Eyes Small Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be able to pick it out.
I think that's why I like Savage Worlds so much for this game, is that, you know, I mean, I like Savage Worlds for most games, I'll be honest,
mm-hmm.
but it's so flexible that you can really do whatever you want with it while still maintaining a rigid mechanical system.
Yeah. I have limited experience with Savage Worlds, but I'll say that my experience with its combat has been that part of the game is not as good as other parts of the game. But I think it would do a fine job. I would say maybe Fate could work here, but the caveat would be, as you were saying, because the setting is so thin, you'd really have to lock into what this show does, which is really backstory as setting. The setting is just the sum of our backstories. And if you went into setting creation in like Fate Core with that in mind, I think you could end up creating things like the Shikon Jewel, you know, the Demon Hunter Village, all of our various feuds with Naraku would come out of that setting creation. And we would never have to have anything like a map of the world or whatever to have, like, this is enough setting for us to play in. It's enough for us to be connected and travel together.
You know, frankly, if you were willing to do the extra work to adapt it, you know, the Marvel Superheroes RPG, which is what we use for Extraordinary League, might work really well for this. Because you can have unique powers and it's kind of the combat is designed for those big, you know, epic anime fights.
Yeah.
So that might actually work really well. You would have to do the relationship stitching together yourself and the background stuff yourself for the most part. But as a basic system, I think with, you know, we tweak it too. So you need to tweak the Marvel Superheroes RPG, but with some tweaks, it could work really well.
You know, actually what occurs to me there, because we were talking earlier about the unconventional morality of Moroku. If I were going to run this with TSR's Marvel game, what I would do is reconfigure the karma system to interface with relationships rather than superhero comic morality.
Oh, I like that.
That way you've got a core combat system that's based on like your powers, your ratings, roll these dice, get the result on the table, whatever. But then you've got a meta system of karma spent to influence your roles that relates to how you're connected to the other characters and whether you've done right by them and that sort of thing.
I actually like that a lot, yeah.
So I think that would be a good compromise.
The moral of this story is everyone should always play the Marvel Superheroes RPG and nothing else. I think that that's kind of what we've come down to between that and League.
I will say that among TSR games that to play them, you have to have a color-coded table that comes on the back of the book, Marvel Superheroes is by far my favorite. So real quick, I do think you could do this with something like D&D if you were more interested in just like doing wandering around fighting monsters, but I would definitely stick to 4E or 5E for this. I would not go any further back because I think too much crunch will kill it.
I definitely would avoid 4E. I think it's too regimented.
4E is not a good game, no. But I would say that like for me, if you had people who are like big Inuyasha fanboys, it might just work because you'll have to skin like cinematic combat on top of it and then have the underlying system be something that is firmly balanced and based on like set special attacks. That strikes me as like maybe not for extended play just because I don't find 4E combat to be very fun. But like I can imagine if Inuyasha is a 4E character, he's got Iron Reaver Soul Stealer as one of his attacks. It's a little power card that he plays. And then we skin it differently depending on, like, you know, what the pyrotechnics of this particular scene are. But yeah, there's a potential there. 5E is much more freeform than 4E. Doesn't have that, like, power cards type of effect.
I would just worry about, you know, about how to represent some of these more extreme abilities in D&D, period.
Yeah.
But again, I haven't played 5E, so maybe it's better about that.
Everything cinematic about this combat would have to go as, like, a fluffy skin on top of the underlying math of D&D, for sure, which is an argument against it. So I think that covers Inuyasha.
Yeah.
Very
thoroughly.
For those who have enjoyed you on Gameable, where can our listeners find you on the internet, Miles?
You can find me over on the Smash Fiction Podcast, which is a show where we take two or more fictional characters and put them into some kind of conflict with each other, be it a brawl or a sneaking contest or a romance contest or whatever. We take two characters that go together. We each pick sides. We all pick sides. There's five of us, two advocates on each side and one judge. And we argue to see who would win in comedic fashion. So that is a really fun show. Chris and Katrina have both been on it before. They were actually on the most recent episode, Hermione Granger versus Willow Rosenberg, which is our witch-off battle, which came out pretty recently. And then once a month, on the first Sunday of every month, our normal episodes are replaced by the Extraordinary League Actual Play RPG Podcast, which is a game where we use the Marvel Super Heroes RPG to represent a version of, you know, our GM Dan's take on the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, although there are much more than just gentlemen in this league, so that's why it's the Extraordinary League. We have a party right now that consists of Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, Morden Solas from Mass Effect, Dante from Devil May Cry, Luna Lovegood, and Sterling Archer. So it's a lot of fun. We get into a lot of wacky adventures on that show. People seem to really enjoy it, so you can check that out by subscribing to the Smash Fiction feed on iTunes or whatever you use to get podcasts. And leave us a review if you like the show. If you don't, please don't. No, I'm just kidding. you can say whatever you want. But leave us a review. Find us on Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter at Smash Fic Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at MJ Schneiderman, MJSCHNEIDERMAN. I'm also the co-host of the Unspoiled Dark Tower podcast, which is a show that I do with the wonderful Natasha Kingston, who does a whole network of Unspoiled shows. Ours is but merely one of the myriad Unspoiled podcasts out there. I am but a vassal of Unspoiled. And we have been covering the Dark Tower series chapter by chapter, or two chapters by two chapters per episode. We're in the middle of Wizard and Glass right now. I've read most of the series. Natasha had not read any of it before we started out. I am rapidly trying to finish the Dark Tower series before she catches up to me, so it's a race against time. That's fun in and of itself, and you can find that on iTunes and all the other places as well. And then you can find some of my writing, if you're interested in award-winning science fiction, on my blog, Universes of the Mind, universesofthemind.com, where I am going through every science fiction novel to win the prestigious Hugo Award for Best Novel in chronological order. I started with The Demolished Man, which came out in 1952, won the award in 1953, and I have now gotten all the way up to the book that won in 55. So I am just moving at a rapid pace through these books. But you know what? They're long books, they're good books, I think a lot about them, I write a lot about them. The most recent installment has to do with They'd Rather Be Right, which was the 55 winner, written by Mark Clifton, and it's an absolutely terrible book that no one can quite figure out how it won the Hugo Award. So, writing about that now, and after that I get to start reading some good shit, like getting into Heinlein and all that stuff. So, that should be a lot of fun. Once again, that's at universesofthemind.com.
Awesome. If you, dear listener, would like to contact us about what other anime we should watch, and probably will not if you write in, so warning there, then you can email us at gameablepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at gameablepodcast, and you can go to gameabledisneypodcast.tumblr.com to find all of our old episodes, including our Pixar and Disney episodes, as well as bonus materials and so on. You can also find the show on iTunes, where you can rate and review. Thank you so much, Miles, for being with me. This has been really fun. It was everything I hoped it would be.
Yeah.
I definitely did not want to do this with an anime fan, so thank you for commiserating with me.
No, it's fine. I actually expected to be a lot angrier on this show than I ended up being. So, you know, well, I had a good time discussing the pros and cons of Inuyasha with you.
Yeah, this is the more thinking, less yelling show. Our little special relationship between Smash Fiction and Gameable, so...
It was fun to spend a few hours thinking more and yelling less. So thank you so much for having me on, Chris.
Next time, dear listener, please join us when we are going to be discussing Gargoyles, the show that not only did everyone want to listen to, but everyone wanted to be on. So that's still being worked out, but we're going to have somebody on to talk about gargoyles next time.
You talking about the characters that faced off against the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in episode 8 of Smash Fiction?
That is correct, yes. So join us next time for that, and we'll see you then.
All right, thanks.
This has been episode 20 of the Gameable Saturday Morning Podcast. The Inuyasha anime and manga are property of their owners. This episode's music, used under Creative Commons licenses, includes We Are Romantic Suiciders by Ryoma Maeda and Romantic Suiciders. You can find their work at ryomamaeda.com. That's ryomamaeda.com. Check out One-Eyed Maestro by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com and Polkamadri's Gitanas Mojadas at polkamadre.com. The Gameable Saturday Morning logo is by Colin Mulcairn. This episode is released under Creative Commons Non-Commercial Sharealike License 4.0. Thanks for listening.